Mr. Whipple, please don't squeeze the Charmin.
Vayikach Korach ben Yitzhar ben Kehas ben Levi Vidasan Vaviram ben Eliyav Veon ben Peles ben Reuven. Korach, the son of Yitzhar, the son of Kehath, the son of Levi, separated himself with Datan and Aviram, sons of Eliyav, and On, son of Pelet, the offspring of Reuven. OU Israel presents...
Come in. Welcome.
Shalom, and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio. I'm your host, Phil Chernofsky, and this show is for Parshat Korach. Recording and first broadcast, Yom Chamishi, Thursday, the first day of Tammuz, 5775, which is the second day of Rosh Chodesh Tammuz, corresponding to June 18th. For those who might not be aware of how the Jewish calendar works that well, any month, our months have fixed number of days. There are 2 months that are variable, but doesn't matter at the moment. The fact of the matter is that a Jewish month has 29 days or 30 days. Any month that has 30 days, its 30th day is the first day of the new month's Rosh Chodesh, as is the first of the new month. A month that has 29 days is followed by a single day Rosh Chodesh, the first of the new month. In other words, if you follow it this way, the day following the 29th is Rosh Chodesh, the first is Rosh Chodesh. Sometimes the day following the 29th is the first, and sometimes the day following the 29th is not yet the first, and there'll be 2 days Rosh Chodesh. I hope you got that, if you needed to. And that's the story. So, because it's Rosh Chodesh, we will do Psalm 121, Tehillim Kuf Kaf Aleph. Shir Lama Alot, Esa Einai El Heharim, Me'ayin Yavo Ezri. Ezri me'im Adonai osei shamayim v'oretz. Al yitain lamot raglecha, al yanum shomerecha. Hine lo yanum v'lo yishan shomer Yisrael. Adonai shomerecha, Adonai tzilecha al yad yuminecha. Yomam hashemesh lo yakeka v'yoreach balayla. Adonai yishmorcha mikol ra yishmoret nafshecha. Adonai yishmoret tzeitecha uvoecha me'ata v'ad olam. Achenu kol Beit Yisrael, hanatunim batzara uvashivya, haomedim mebein bayam uvein bayabasha, hamakom yirachem aleihem, viyotziyem mitzara lirvacha, umeafela laora, umishibud lagu'ula, hashta ba'agala uvizman kariv, vinomar, amen. As far as the opening audio clip, I think, I don't know if I used it before, in Torah Tibbetz audio, but I wrote something about it or pictured something in Torah Tibbetz hard print, so I'm just going to give it away now. It just always struck me. The commercial, the clip was from a commercial for Charmin toilet paper. They had this series in the 60s and 70s of kind of an obnoxious commercial with the a grocery store manager who put up signs saying, please don't squeeze the Charmin. It was so soft that everybody who touched it felt like squeezing the package, and even he gave in to that temptation. I'll tell you in a moment why I put that on for this week. But I remember reading an article in Newsweek a long time ago that on advertising, that the Charmin commercials were the most hated commercials on television and the most effective, which is a very smart thing for an advertising agency to do. People couldn't stand the commercials. They were very obnoxious, but the message got across. And when it comes to toilet paper, a person is more interested in soft than he is in a clever commercial or a cute commercial or a funny commercial. Conversely, the funniest advertising commercials were deemed not so effective because people were entertained by them, but they forgot what product they were advertising. Almost like a trivia kind of quiz. You tell somebody, "I can't believe I ate the whole thing." That was a very funny series of commercials, but you need to really think a long time till you say, Alka-Seltzer, if you get it at all. Anyway, put all of that aside. In Hebrew, so soft would be Korach, as in Parshat Korach. Not the right spelling, but that doesn't matter. This is how riddles work, and that opening audio clip from that commercial was a tribute to Korach. Okay. If you remember back in Parshat Bahalotcha, we had a turning point in the Torah. The Torah is actually, or the book of Bamidbar, is actually divided in two parts, and the middle piece that divides the two major halves are those two psukim, Vayhi ben Soha Aaron and Uvnucho Yomar. They are bracketed off by backwards written nuns, a very unusual, actually unique scribal tradition. And it went from more or less good stuff in the Midbar to the complaining, the kvetching, the rebellion. And in last week's Sedra, Shlach, we had what should have been, no, I shouldn't even put it like that. We had what is described as the final straw. God says to Moshe, after the sin of the spies and the panic of the people, that he wants to destroy the entire nation and start all over again from Moshe. And Moshe intercedes and he argues, and God gives in, so to speak. Now, this so to speak is an important concept, because God does not have human emotions. God does not get angry. God does not change his mind. This is how we speak of God anthropomorphically, in human terms, because it happens to be the only way we understand and the only way we can speak. So if God doesn't really get angry and lose his cool, and he is not really assuaged by arguments, then what exactly are we talking about? The description of the Torah of God's anger is to make the point. Maybe you could even say it like this: God says to the people, to us, if I were human and I would react to this situation, I'd be really, really upset. I don't know if that's the best way to put it, but it makes the statement that we really, really, really did a bad thing, that we would have been deserving of being wiped out, but we weren't. And the warrant is sometimes keeping God's promises to the patriarchs, and sometimes Moshe's argument is, what will the other nations say if you take us out of Egypt only to kill us here in the Midbar. And these, again, these are, let's call it part of that concept of Tzimtzum, God minimizing himself, reducing himself so that we can understand certain emotional things, even though those aren't actually attributable to God. In any event, there's an outburst, and if I don't say so to speak, put it in yourself. There is an outburst by God saying, this is the 10th time that they have provoked my anger since they came out of Egypt. And commentaries attempt to actually count out the 10 times. Clearly, the sin of the golden calf is among those 10. The Chet HaMeraglim, the sin of the spies, is among those 10. I would say, for sure, it's number 10. And 10 is it's the first number that's not describing individuals, it's a group. That's how the decimal system works. We don't have a digit to represent 10. We take a 1 and a 0 as a placeholder, indicating that the 1 is not unit, but it is one group of 10. As opposed to 9, 8, 7, 6, and all the other digits, which describe a collection of individual items. What I mean by that is that when the Torah uses the term 10 years, 10 times, and when Chazal use it, like in the Mishnah of this past Shabbat's, of this Shabbat's Perek Hay, in Chutz La'aretz, it'll be next week's Perek, and it speaks about 10 divine sayings, the world came into existence, and 10 generations, and 10 things that happened, and 10 miraculous events. 10 is not merely just a collection of individual items. It is a significant, complete group. So when God says they have provoked my anger 10 times, it would be in the form of, and that's it. And I say all of this, even though it belongs in last week's Sedra, because in Korach, we get it again in spades. So that first list of 10 doesn't even include Korach's disastrous rebellion against God and Moshe and the authority. And the follow-up of that is utter despair on the part of the people. And so it's more than 10. And you keep going in the Chumash, and you'll find other times we provoke God again and again and again. It's a very depressing kind of thing. What I came up with out of all of the above is, I guess, what we could call not just a bright spot, but a remarkable reminder that no matter how bad it is, we still have a special relationship with God. And I refer to the second verse of the second chapter of the book of Yirmiyahu. I'll read the first two verses in English translation. And the word of Hashem was upon me, saying, go and proclaim in the ears of Jerusalem, saying, thus said Hashem, I remember for your sake the kindness of your youth, the love of your bridal days, your following after me in the wilderness, in a land not sown. I find that incredible, because we're talking about God who is not forgetful and who does not paper over things. And he speaks through the prophet Yirmiyahu, Jeremiah, lovingly of the people of Israel who followed him at his command through the wilderness in their youth, meaning in the early years of their national existence. What's incredible about that is all of the above. The complaining. We're thirsty. Why did you take us out of Egypt? We could have died there. There was not enough graves in Egypt. Give us water. Okay, they got water. We're hungry. We want food, which is reasonable, but not the way they said things. And they got the mun, and it was miraculous, and they were impressed, and they were instructed not to go, not to leave over for the next day, and they did. And then they were instructed to leave over for Shabbat and not to go out and collect the mun. And the Torah tells us that there were people who went out to collect mun on Shabbat. And on and on and on. Golden calf, sin of the spies, Korach's rebellion, this kvetch, that kvetch, to the point where we had a description of complaining without the Torah even telling us what they were complaining about. Just they were complaining. And occasionally a plague broke out, a fire broke out, a couple of thousand people here, 14,700 fell victim there in the fiasco that we'll read about in 2 weeks' time in Parshat Balak, death toll of 24,000. And it was like kvetching all the time, complaining all the time. And yet God says, Zacharti lach, Chesed Nu'urayich, Ahavat Kilulotayich, Lechtech Acharai Bamidbar Be'eretz Lo Zerua. This is not only a pasuk from Yirmiyahu, it's a pasuk that we quote on Rosh Hashanah, Yom Hadin, Judgment Day, in our favor. So the dynamics in the Midbar are extremely difficult to understand. We cannot judge that generation. We don't know how things were then, and that's a general guideline that should be followed. We know that there were negative things, and yet we have God's testimony that he fondly remembers our kindness in our youth and in the bridal days. So to me, that was the comforting thought on an otherwise depressing pair of sedras, Shlach and Korach. Just as a side point, in the modern calendar, whenever Shavuot is a Friday in Israel, it's Friday and Shabbat outside Israel, and we get out of sync in Parshat HaShavuah. We were out of sync this year for a number of weeks, but that was because of Pesach. This is a different situation. When Shavuot is Friday, we get out of sync in reading of the weekly portion, and the makeup, or the back into sync reading, comes in Chukat and Balak, next week and the week after. Chukat and Balak, which are combined outside of Israel in those years when Shavuot falls on Friday, and separated at all other times. In Israel, that pair is never combined. I remember seeing in Seder HaIbur, which is a book on the Jewish calendar written by the Avudraham, where he wrote there that they used to combine Shlach and Korach, not Chukat and Balak. And I found that interesting because of what I've been saying now, where I find not parallels between Shlach and Korach, but I find that they really go hand in hand in not such a good way of the, you know, the rebellion with the Meraglim and the rebellion with Korach, and the connection between them being the last part of Shlach, which was the portion of Tzitzit, and it mentioned the Petil Techelet, and Korach, according to the Medrash, used that as an argument where he dressed people in garments made of blue-dyed wool, and he tauntingly challenged Moshe with a question: does a garment that's all tchelet require a thread of tchelet on its tzitzit? The answer is yes, it does. But his point was, that's absurd. If a thread of tchelet is a reminder of things holy, then certainly an entire garment made of tchelet would be also a reminder, and it wouldn't need the addition of the petil tchelet. He was using that as an analogy to saying, what does a holy people need holy leaders and prophets if we're all holy and we all receive divine revelation at Sinai? In any event, the two sedras are definitely of the same type. And one of the things that I personally find remarkably similar, I don't know how better to put it, is the fact that we have a story that takes up about two-thirds of the Sedra, Chet HaMeraglim and Korach, and then another third that has different mitzvah topics, which are after the story, not part of the story, but we can't avoid the message that story has an input, I don't know if that's the right word either, to the mitzvot that follow. I won't review the ones from Shlach, but we definitely find this phenomenon in Korach, and we'll speak about that in a moment. Let me clarify what I'm about to talk about. I think I've said this as recently as last week, but here it is again. There are some mitzvot in the Torah that have no story, no context to speak of. A mitzvah prohibiting the wearing of garments made with wool and linen, known as sha'atnez, has no context. It's just stated in the Torah that you're not allowed to do it. There are other mitzvot like that. Then there are mitzvot that come from within a story. In Parshat Bo, the story of the Exodus, the night before leaving Egypt, it is filled with story and mitzvot for perpetuity, in perpetuity. So you have the mitzvah to eat matzah, and the night of the Seder, and the Korban Pesach, and the prohibition of chametz, and all of that, which is from within the story. Hold that thought. We'll be right back with Torah Tidbits Audio for Parshat Korach. You are listening to Torah Tibbetz Audio for Parshat Korach. The music that began this second half is from something called Flower of the Month. I have no idea what it is. I looked it up on Internet Movie Database and didn't find it. I found it on this television theme song where I get a lot of my musical clips from. But didn't have a chance to fully search the internet. Doesn't matter. It's called Flower of the Month, and it's a reference in the Sedra to the flowering of the staff of Aharon. There was a, I don't know what you want to call it, a ceremony where each tribe submitted a stick, staff, a branch with the name of their tribe or the name of their tribal leader engraved on the staff, and Aharon's representing Shevet Levi. The 12 were taken together, were put into the Mishkan, and on the following morning, the staff of Aharon had budded and blossomed and flowered with almond tree flowers, and the others remained barren, and it was a sign of the divine authority behind the appointment of Aharon in answer to the rebellion of Korach. And so that was it, flower of the month. What I was saying before is that mitzvot either are presented without context or within a context, or with a smichut, a juxtaposition. The mitzvot in Shlach follow the story. There are no mitzvot within the story, but it's very hard to ignore the fact that these mitzvot are presented in the Torah immediately following the story of, in the case of Shlach, the sin of the spies, and in the case of Korach, the rebellion of Korach and his gang. So when you look at these mitzvot, they could have been any place else. In fact, some of them are other places, but they're here again to make the point. And the point here is kind of obvious. There are 9 mitzvot in Korach, plus reference to others that are counted elsewhere, and I find that significant also. And they all deal with the sanctity of the Kohen and the Levi and the obligations that the non-Kohen, non-Levi have towards the Kohen, towards the Levi, and the obligations that the Levi has toward the Kohen, and the responsibility of the Kohen and the Levi in communal service. So if that was the major flaw in Korach's rebellion, then the Torah is not just telling us a story, but is showing us mitzvot that are perpetual reminders in our daily practice of mitzvot of the fact that it was not what Korach said, that we're all equal and we're all holy and we don't need leaders and we don't need special categories. We have them, and they're important. A Kohen is a Kohen, a Levi is a Levi. They're not allowed to do each other's jobs, and the Yisrael is not allowed to encroach on the territory of the Kohen and the Levi, but the Kohen and the Levi don't get their own land in Eretz Yisrael. On the other hand, the tribes contribute a total of 48 cities for the Levim and Kohanim to live in, and the area around them, and there is an interrelationship among the groups. I find it interesting, and therefore I'm going to mention it now. Fact of the matter is that in the Beit HaMikdash, the Kohanim have their tasks, and no one's allowed to do them. The Levim have their tasks, but nothing can begin on each day of service in the temple without a Yisrael, a non-Kohen and a non-Levi, giving the order to proceed. In other words, there is a responsibility to the people on the part of the Kohanim and Levim that they don't perform their functions when they feel like it, but only when the congregation, the Kahal, the people of Israel, instruct them to begin their service. So in each morning, when the Kohanim are in place waiting for sunrise to bring the morning sacrifice and its accompanying offerings, and everything else that's done in the Beit HaMikdash, it is a Yisrael who is on duty with his region's Kohanim who gives the order to proceed. And I've always found that very interesting. We have something like it in Birchat Kohanim. In Israel, where we say Birchat Kohanim every day and twice on Shabbat, the Kohanim go up to the Duchan to bless the people, and when the Chazan gets up to that portion of the repetition of the Amidah, the Kohanim do not start until a non-Kohen says out loud, Kohanim, and that allows them to proceed with their bracha for the bracha that they will give to the people. Technical point, when there's only one Kohen, he starts without any instruction, but that's a side point. And there are also, I think, more in Edot Mizrach and Sfaradi shuls where the Chazan doesn't begin davening until instructed to by a gabbai. The laning doesn't proceed until instructed by a gabbai, because this is all with permission of the congregation. It's not, I am a Kohen and I will do whatever I want. No, you're going to be instructed when to do what you do by one of the people that you are serving, a Yisrael. Around the country, there were 24 geographic regions, and each region had a team, for lack of a better word, of Kohanim, another team of Levi'im, and another group of Yisraelim, who received 1 week every half year, approximately, when they were to serve in the Beit HaMikdash. To put it differently, there were some full-time jobs in the Beit HaMikdash. Kohen Gadol was full-time, for example, and many others. But the bulk of the service of the Kohanim was done for a week at a time, twice a year. And during that week that the Kohanim were in of a certain region were in charge, they would travel to Jerusalem, and they would divide up into 6 days of the week, and they would all be there on Shabbat, and Levi'im as well, and for the accompanying singing and Shmirah, and the Yisraelim. And the Yisraelim, some would stay back in the regional capital to say certain prayers every day on behalf of their team of Kohanim and Levi'im, and some would accompany them to Yerushalayim, and there were things that were done here in Yerushalayim. I don't know all the details, but there was a partnership there. And this perhaps, you know, bears saying, because Korach missed the point, and in a big way. In this latter third of Parshat Korach, with the mitzvot that I referred to, we have reference to the Matnot Kehuna, the 24 gifts that the Kohen receives from the people, some only in the time of the Beit HaMikdash, only from Korbanot, others are perpetuated today in token form until things are restored to the way they could be done properly, and other things proceed today as they've always been. For example, Bechor, Pidyon HaBen, redemption of the firstborn son. This is one of the 24 gifts of the Kohuna, one that exists today the way it always has been. And just speculating the other day about the odds of a family having a Pidyon HaBen. I don't have a good statistic on it. If anyone does, let me know. But you have a situation where the firstborn of a woman, in order to have a Pidyon HaBen, needs to be a boy as opposed to a girl, so that already is down to 50%. Then neither maternal or paternal grandfather can be a Kohen or a Levi, otherwise there's no Pidyon HaBen, so that knocks out a bunch of other percents, however many. And a cesarean delivery, even of a firstborn, precludes the necessity of Pidyon HaBen. and a birth following a miscarriage, more than 40 days, will not have a pinyon haben. So the actual statistic is kind of low. I personally had a pinyon haben, so my parents told me. I am their firstborn. And I have three daughters. My brothers each had girls first, so there was no pinyon haben in their families. As far as my children are concerned, each of my daughters married a non-Kohen and non-Levi, and each had a boy first, and each had a pinyon haben. And that's kind of rarish, we'll say. I was counting up for my brothers, but you could all do this for your own families. How many pinyon habens have you been to? Certainly compared with how many Brit Milah you've been to. And the pinyon habens are rarer. They're interesting, and we won't get involved into all of the details at this moment. The fact of the matter is, to not digress, but to elaborate a little. I almost said embellish. I take that word back. But to elaborate, there are three kinds of Bechor. Now, let me make it clear. Not all of them are presented to us as mitzvot in Parshat Korach. Some are and some are not, but I'm putting it all together. The three types of Bechor, firstborns, are human, which we've already discussed. A human firstborn male requires a pidyon, redemption from a Kohen. It's not an option, it's a requirement. Firstborn of a kosher domesticated animal, namely cow, goat, and sheep, is sacred and is given as a gift to a Kohen, and he is obligated to bring that animal as a sacrifice in the Beit HaMikdash within the first year of the animal's life. And there is no redemption allowed. Any attempt at redeeming or exchanging the sanctity of that firstborn animal does not succeed, and the penalty includes that the animal that you attempted to switch with it becomes sacred as well. Let me just make a point which I've said in the past. I think it's an important point to keep in mind. The mitzvah of the sanctity of a firstborn of a domesticated animal, where the requirement is to raise it yourself for 30 days in the case of a sheep or a goat, meaning a lamb or a kid, and 50 days in the case of a calf, and then give it to the Kohen of your choice. This mitzvah, surprisingly, applies in our time as well as in the time of the Beit HaMikdash. What does that mean? It means today, no Beit HaMikdash, today, if a Jew owns a cow, and the cow becomes pregnant for her first time, and it's a boy, then that calf is sacred, has to be raised for 50 days by the owner of the cow and the calf, and then given as a gift to the Kohen of his choice. Today, the Kohen is required to take care of the animal and at his discretion bring it as a korban, a sacrifice in the Beit HaMikdash, within the animal's first year. And then the meat is eaten by his family, him and his family, and that's the way it should go. Little problem, we don't have a Beit HaMikdash. And that creates a situation where a Kohen would have to take care of this animal until there is the ability to bring it as a korban bechor in the Beit HaMikdash, or the animal dies of natural causes, whichever comes first. And that could mean years and years of feeding an animal and caring for it and taking it to the vet when it needs to be taken and not benefiting from it ever. Not the wool that you shear when the animal needs to be shorn, not the carcass of the animal when it eventually dies. And this, our sages said, is an untenable situation to put a Kohen into. You're giving him a burden, you're not giving him a gift, and it's going to cost him a lot of money, and maybe he'll do something that he's not allowed to do and do damage to the animal, or let it take it on a ride into the country and leave it there, not allowed to do any of that stuff. And therefore, our sages said, even though the mitzvah applies in our time, we're going to teach you how to get out of the mitzvah so that you do not perform it and create this difficult situation. Their solution was simple. They said, during the pregnancy of the mother animal, sell a small part of it, a tenth of a percent or whatever, to a non-Jew in exchange for a token amount of money. Give me a shekel for a tenth of a percent of this adult sheep, female, E-U-E-W-E, in Hebrew, Rachel. And then when the animal gives birth, that baby, even if it's a male, has no sanctity because the mother animal is jointly owned by a Jew and a non-Jew. Technicality of the law. Therefore, there's no sanctity, there's no need to give it as a gift to a Kohen, and there's no need to bring it as a korban in the Beit HaMikdash. Problem solved. Not the greatest solution, because it means that our sages have to teach us not only how to do mitzvot, but also how to avoid doing mitzvot. Interesting that the next chapter, next section in the Shulchan Aruch, takes the case, which is the third kind of bechor, that is the firstborn male of a non-kosher animal, specifically and exclusively a donkey. For a donkey, firstborn, the Torah says you have a choice, a preferred choice and a backup choice. The preferred choice is redeeming the animal by giving a sheep or the equivalent monetary value of a sheep to a Kohen in exchange for the baby donkey. Then it becomes yours. Till then, you're not allowed to use it, do anything with it. The alternative for someone who refuses to redeem a firstborn donkey is to destroy it. And that's why it's not a preferred option, because it is wasteful and cruel. We'll say cruel, and therefore you should redeem it. It turns out that the procedure called Pidyon Peter Chamor is still carried out in our time, and the Shulchan Aruch makes a comment by saying, even though we taught you how to get out of the mitzvah that would present a problem of the firstborn of the domesticated kosher animals because of their sacredness, do not use the same method, even though it'll work, to get out of the mitzvah of Pidyon Peter Chamor. In other words, a person who owns a female donkey, called in English a jenny, called in Hebrew an aton. You own a female donkey, you have to, and she's pregnant for the first time. Baby is born, and it is a cute little baby boy donkey. It is not sacred, but you're not allowed to benefit from it, not allowed to do anything with it until it is redeemed. And there is a ceremony of redemption of a firstborn donkey, which is carried out from time to time in Israel and elsewhere. But that all comes from Parshat Korach and other places in the Torah where the topic of Bechor is presented. Let me get back to something that I basically started with. And that is, we, the Jewish people, have a unique relationship with God. And God, in his infinite mercy and patience and kindness, maintains that relationship even when we betray it. And Shlach and Korach, I picture in my mind, were two instances in the wilderness where basically there was an announced competition. Do we follow what the ten Meraglim are saying, that the land which God wants us to live in eats up its inhabitants and we wouldn't want to live there and let's stay here in the Midbar, and other people said let's go back to Egypt? Or do you listen to the two Meraglim, Yehoshua and Kalev, who said, Alo na'aleh, let's go. If this is what God wants, then certainly we'll prevail. And it goes on and on. Imagine how good things would be if we chose the right path. On that note, I wish you a Chodesh Tov, Shabbat Shalom, Lehishtameah.